Has anybody thought about this? What is, what might be? Yes. It's not random population, it is. I didn't hear you. You're just speaking too softly. Okay. So that's the answer that she has is basically database searches is not done by mere mortals such as yourself, but by specially trained people, and web search on the other hand is done by everybody. Do people agree with that or not agree with that? Well, I mean, if you type some random SQL query, there should be some reasonable results. You know, irrespective of where you are going, you will see some flights going from somewhere to somewhere from Sabre database, right? Would you be happy with that? You obviously are not. Any other comments on this? I mean, my own take is basically hers, which is that it really is because databases have assumed, I mean, the original database research, database work has assumed that people would be specially trained to feel that SQL is even better than English, and that they can then write SQL queries, and so they're supposed to know how to write them well. Whereas we are not specially, Google doesn't have a training program for its users. You know, they don't train people to how to use search engines. You know, so any random person might actually be searching. Okay. Now, this actually is, in fact, I think, a very reasonable explanation, and which also says that if databases were to come out of their shell and, you know, say databases are only for specially trained SQL query writers, then they also would have to deal with the same problems that we have to deal with in text retrieval. Okay, so if you were to allow normal people to access databases, which is increasingly the case right now, right? I mean, on the web, in fact, many, many things that you're looking at have back-end databases. Okay, so it's amazing. I mean, by different estimates, you know, a large part of the web, like, you know, some people say 60, 70, 80% of the web, you know, a page that you would see when you are interacting with the web. This page may actually not be a static URL at all. It is something that a database on the back just generated on the fly and showed it to you. Okay, so you are actually talking to databases, and so some of the same issues of precision, relevance, having an idea of the relevance of what the user might actually be looking for, and thinking of search as used car selling rather than as just basically. So there are two different search models, right? One is the used car salesperson search model where you go for something and they'll sell you everything else that they have. The other is Safeway search model where you go exactly with your understanding of what you want to buy, and that's the only thing you'll get. Nobody is trying to, except for those people who try to give us nice food and get us interested in, like, you know, this new pie, you know, is interesting, etc. Mostly you go with what you want to buy and you get out with that, okay? So I think databases should also go into the used car kind of a thing, which is basically the having an idea of user relevance model. And there's a lot of research on that, in that direction, and we'll come to talk about it towards probably the end of the course on stuff that falls in the middle of information retrieval and databases. People now are wondering, what does it mean to support keyword searches on databases? Now you think, you know, why would anybody want to do keyword search on database? I mean, database is for SQL, right? But if people want to only ask keyword questions, you just want to deal with that, okay? Any other questions, not necessarily on this, but anything else that came up in your mind about last class? So the basic idea is today I'll try to be done with the vector space model and also talk a little bit about the indexing and retrieval issues. and that would be sufficient enough to get you started on project one, the part one of the project. What I would suggest is you look at part one of the project by next Wednesday, and probably if you have questions on that, we'll talk about a little bit about any specific questions you might have, any technical questions in terms of how to get started and so on. Basically, you would be almost doing vector space ranking when somebody has already given you an index. That's all. It's a very, very simple part. First part is a very simple part. Okay. And as we are going with other stuff, you could at least start getting busy with that. Okay. There was one mistake I made last time. The Jaccard similarity metric is normally defined in terms of the ratio between intersection and the union, and the unions for bags are defined in terms of maxes, and the intersections in terms of mins of the number of values of a particular item, and that's what we actually talked about in this slide. But there, I actually did summation. So this is change slide. Just make sure that you don't do the summation. Okay. So we already have talked about bags, vectors, the documents as bags, and now, so this is a document. It's a bag of six different items, and each item there are so many instances of it. That's basically the point. So here, 24 T1s, 21 T2s, and so on. Okay. What we'll do now is talk about looking at the same bag as a vector rather than as a bag. Okay. If you think of it as a vector, it's not a big deal. I mean, basically, you already have the dimensions for the vector are T1 to T6. Okay. And the coefficients are the weights. Basically, in this particular case, the number of instances of each item. And so each document is a vector in the space of terms. The T's are terms. The keywords are terms. Okay. So you can think of each document as a vector in the space of terms. And so here, basically, the dimensionality of the space is what for this particular example? Six dimensions. Okay. So we have six-dimensional space, and each of your documents are essentially vectors or points in that space. Okay. By the way, there is nothing, when I have a matrix like this, I could also think of terms as vectors in the space of documents. I mean, if you're into thinking of things as vectors, you can actually think of terms as vectors in the space of documents. And we will do it in some cases. If you, for example, here is an interesting way of thinking about it. Suppose you want to realize that certain terms are very close to each other. Remember, a couple of classes back, I was pointing out that you might be able to find that two words are very similar in meaning just because they seem to occur together all the time. Okay, and you want to do this automatically. How would you want to do it automatically? One way is to think of terms as vectors, okay, in the space of documents. And then if you see how close they are, that means this term seems to be appearing in all the documents the other term is appearing, then you suddenly have a notion of term similarity. I'm again jumping in terms of talking about vectors being close and so on, but I'm assuming that you looked at the slides already and that, you know, all I'm going to do is elaborate a little bit. So we will talk about, you can think of documents as a documents as vectors in the term space or terms as vectors in the document space. And to make things even more fun, you know, at some point of time when we talk about latent semantic indexing, we will say that really neither are documents nor terms, I mean both of them are actually vectors in a yet another third space called factor space. Okay. So in latent semantic indexing, we'll assume that there is a that the axes are actually defined neither in terms of documents nor in terms of terms, but in other terms. Okay, basically we'll call them factors, and then each of these, the terms as well as documents, would be legitimate vectors in that space. It's a nice thing, and you know, it turns out that it allows us to do interesting things for that. Okay, so as I mentioned, vector space, it's just a tip of the iceberg. The first thing we just think about is, you know, documents as vectors of terms. Okay. Now, if you do this, then the basic hope, of course, is everything that you ever heard of about vectors can just be copied over to this problem now. Okay. So you have vector distances, and you can copy those over to decide similarity of vectors and so on. And that's basically what we're going to do. Okay. But one thing I want to ask you is this. What's important in a vector, when you talk about a vector, there's an important assumption you make, which is that all the dimensions are orthogonal. Okay, so x, if you have a three-dimensional vector, then it has a coefficient in x direction, coefficient in y direction, coefficient in z direction. Now, the important point there is the projection, essentially, of this vector onto the x-axis is independent of its projection onto y-axis and is independent of its projection onto z-axis. That's what it means to say dimensions are independent. Tell me dimensions which won't be independent. Can you think of dimensions that won't be independent? Suppose my two axes are, axis one is x, axis two is 2x. Okay? So in essence, every vector in this space has really only one independent parameter, which is, let's say, either you can take the 2x1 or the x1. That's the independent parameter. The other one is determined. The moment you know the x-axis of the vector, you know the y-axis of the vector, the y-coefficient of the vector. Independent means even if I tell you, if it's a 10,000-dimensional vector, and I told you 9,999 coefficients of this vector, you still don't know anything about that last coefficient. You don't at all know anything about that last coefficient. That's why it's independent. That's why you can't throw away that information. Okay? Now, if I were to actually start with a two-dimensional vector, which is an x and y, basically it's a two-dimensional vector in a two-dimensional space, and I make up new vectors, okay? So where one, so basically I would start with something like, so to start with something like, you know, so there is what we normally say 2i plus 3j vector, okay? This is the vector. Any vector I have here, I would take this and I will have a new, before I give it to you, I decide that I would write it this way, 2i plus 3j plus 4k plus 6l plus 5m, okay? What I did here is, you realize that what I did here is 4 is because 2 times 2 is 4. So 2 times the x-axis becomes the k-axis. Okay, 2 times i-axis becomes the k-axis. 2 times the j-axis becomes the l-axis. And the i-axis plus j-axis becomes the m-axis. Okay, just to you make sense, make sure that you understand this. Suppose now I have 4i plus 7j. What would I do before I give it to you? I would have said 8i, I mean, so no, it's still 4i, plus 7j, plus 8k, plus 14l, plus 11m. Now I give you, let's assume that I actually gave you these vectors, not these vectors. So I am, you know, for some reason I want to mess with your mind. And so you are a vector-oriented guy, and I actually have a two-dimensional, bunch of two-dimensional vectors, and I'm doing this kind of crazy thing to them. Okay, essentially, I'll not only start with my original dimensions, but add up dimensions to make new dimensions. In general, I might, for now, assume that the new dimensions are possibly linear combinations of the old dimensions, general linear combinations. So five times first dimension plus 7 times second dimension plus 9 times third dimension is going to be 24th dimension now. If I give you these vectors, you look at these vectors now, I mean, for now forget about the fact that you just heard what I said, how I got it. If you were to see them for the first time, what do you think, what would you have thought as the dimensionality of these vectors? what would you have thought as a dimensionality vector? It is basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 dimensions. Okay? You would have thought it is a 5-dimensional vector. But you really know it is not a 5-dimensional vector. It was a 2-dimensional vector masquerading as a 5-dimensional vector. And the way you can actually figure this out, even if I didn't tell you that I messed with your mind, the way you can actually figure this out is very easily using matrix theory. You can figure out that if you were to take the matrix of weights of this vector, that would not have rank k, rank 5. It would have much less rank. Do you know the word rank, by the way? This is linear algebra stuff where you're saying, you know, you could have a matrix and you can generate a new matrix which has new terms which are linear combinations of the old terms in the various rows. And if you have such a situation, then the rank of this linearly dependent matrix would be the same as the rank of the original matrix, even though it has more dimensions. So there's a bunch of theory out there which would tell you actually what is the right dimensionality. My question is, why am I talking about this? Why do I think this kind of messing with my mind might have happened when I'm looking at text vectors? So for example, I'm looking at documents as vectors in the space of terms. What possible reason is there for me to believe that in fact these documents, first of all, let's talk about this. What would be a typical size of the document vector in terms of dimensionality, let's say in search engine scenarios? So guess, I mean, give me a number. What is the dimensionality of the vectors we are talking about? 5, 29, 3 billion, 4 million, what? Million, close to millions, because basically it depends on the number of distinct terms in the language. Number of distinct terms in the language. So take whichever is your nicest dictionary, and you know, basically all the terms in the dictionary are different dimensions. So we are talking about vector algebra. We are going to do vector manipulation, except all these vectors are, you know, millions of dimensions. No, I didn't want to write this. So in the previous case, there were only 6 dimensions. That's because I only decided 6 keywords are worth talking about. Everything else is unless use them. But in the case of search engines, you know that every word is more or less considered as a term, as a keyword. All words are considered as keywords. Okay. So in fact, the size of the vector in terms of dimensionality is really, really, really large. Okay. And most documents are how many words long? Close to 1 million words long, close to 10 words long, close to 100 words long. It's nowhere near 1 million words long. So if you were to write the document as a vector, what is the thing that you keep seeing? Zeros, first point. Okay, these are all sparse vectors. Millions and millions of zeros. I mean, of course, there are only 1 million words and hundreds of thousands of zeros in each vector. So the bunch of things that are coming out. One is, these are going to be sparse vectors, so you better be able to write algorithms that use the sparseness. You know, certain algorithms are better at dealing with sparse matrices, sparse vectors. Certain algorithms are much better, more or less assume that there are no zeros. And so you might as well look at the sparse vector manipulation method. The second thing is, what is the chance that 1 million words are all independent of each other? 1 million words are all independent of each other. What is the chance that there are actually 1 million different dimensions? So think about the following thing. Suppose I have a bunch of documents about more or less talking about computer science. Okay? There's going to be one dimension called computer, another dimension called science. Okay? Do you think there is going to be a relation between the number of computers and the number of sciences in this document? Yeah, of course it is going to be. And yet you thought there were 2 extra dimensions instead of 1 dimension. And think of this in the worst possible scenario. You could wind up having, you know, many, many dependencies between dimensions. Okay? In fact, the n-dimensional things that we are talking about, the n-dimensional space that we are talking about, is not n-dimensional space at all. they are not orthogonal axes at all. And when we assume that documents are vectors, we're just assuming that all the axes are independent. This is a totally bogus assumption, totally bogus assumption. The beauty of it is we'll make it and we'll act as if, you know, who's going to care? And it turns out nobody seems to care. In fact, Google makes this assumption. And since Google defines what is reasonable, apparently we are assuming that computer and science are independent. Okay? There is a bigger point here. I'll come to your question. There's a bigger point here, which is we'll notice that in many cases, there are interesting algorithms. We'll talk about, for example, naive Bayes classifier, where you wind up making completely silly assumptions, such as independence assumptions of this sort. And nobody in their right mind would believe that that assumption makes sense. And yet, it seems to give reasonable results. Now, the word reasonable is very interesting operative word. All that means is no smarter guy exists right now to kill you. So if you're the only game in town, you know, any answer is better than no answer. Okay, so Google is giving this answer with this humongous hole built in. You know, we're assuming that vectors of, you know, millions of dimensions, most of which are actually dependent, and yet it doesn't care. Now, keep this issue of dimensionality in the back of your head. It should bother you. Okay? And by the way, one of the interesting things is if you did know that these are the true vectors and these are the made up vectors, you can go back. It would be nice to convert this back to its old shape, which is basically two dimensionality. So somehow go back from the new space, the space that's given to you, which is large number of dimensions, to the latent space, the real space in which these vectors were originally living before people, you know, messed up with your brain and changed them into something else. There are lots of advantages of reducing the number of dimensions. If in fact it's a two-dimensional vector, it can masquerade as a million-dimensional vector. And unless you know what you look for, you would actually be dealing with million-dimensional vectors instead of dealing with two-dimensional vectors. And I think even if you're doing, I guess the simplest question is, it would be easier to write a million-dimensional vector on a piece of paper. I mean, easier to write a two-dimensional vector on a piece of paper and do some of the homework problems. So you would like to reduce dimensionality. But it turns out that there are many other reasons as to why you should reduce dimensionality, because the true distance between vectors should probably be defined in that example in this space. These are the true vectors. So to talk about the distance between them, whatever distance measure you use, you should be defining it in this space. Suppose you would be talking about dot product as the distance. So dot product here would be 8 plus 21, right? Which is 29. Now what would it be here? It'll be different. It'll be bigger. How big can it be? As big as you want me to make it. I just keep making more and more random dimensions which are sort of linearly dependent on the old ones. And the distance that you observe between these vectors in this space may not have anything to do with their real distance in the original space. Okay? And so it's important to be able to actually realize the true dimensionality of the vector and manipulate it in that correct space. And we will talk about how to reduce dimensionality. There are many, many ways of reducing dimensionality. One of the things is this latent semantic indexing we'll talk about. That works as long as the way I messed up with your head is to take these vectors and make the new vectors as linear combinations of the original vectors. Linear combinations of the original vectors. Okay? Any linear combination is fine. It's not even necessary that, in fact, I could have made new vectors by just adding up these two vectors. Okay? All linear combinations are okay. But you could do other things. You don't have to do linear combinations if you are trying to get me into trouble. You know, this is like coding. You know, think of it as this is the truth, and you want to kind of code it such that I won't know what the real vector is. I could have done nonlinear manipulations. I could have said the new vectors, my dimensions would be squares, cubes, square roots, you know, sine functions, all that stuff of the original coefficients. And in then case, in that case too, actually the, all these arguments will hold. You know, so the question is, how would you go back to the original dimensional space? Okay. The nice thing is, we don't right now. We'll just act as if we don't care. We'll assume, we'll take the vectors on their face value and assume that they're all independent dimensions, and then see what we can do. Okay. There are all sorts of interesting things about higher dimensions. Think about the following thing. Suppose you have a three-dimensional apple, which is a spherical shape, okay, and you peel the apple so that you essentially removed an epsilon thick skin off of the apple. Intuitively, how much mass do you think is left over? So basically, what's the fraction of the apple that's left to the original apple? You have eaten apples and you know that, you know, you peel only because actually there is apple left over. Large amount of apple is left over. Okay? If it's an n-dimensional apple, n very large, what do you think would be the ratio of the apple that's left after you peeled it to the apple that was there before you, before the peeling? Zero. As n goes to infinity, you're essentially thinking of r minus epsilon. R is the radius, minus epsilon is the new sphere, power n by r power n. So this is r minus epsilon by r power n. So that's less than 1, n tends to infinity, you see what's going on. So in fact, all sorts of crazy things actually happen at very high dimensions, even if in fact, so there are, all this while I was talking about the fact that the original dimensionality of the vector may not actually be the high dimensions, and so you should go back. But there's another way of looking at it, which is even if in fact there are million dimensions for these vectors, they're all really truly independent, you may still want to get out of the high dimensional space and try to do work in the low dimensional space, because many of your intuitions actually don't hold. Okay, so all n-dimensional vectors are all peel and no core. It's just peel. You know, you remove the peel, there is no apple left. Okay, and this is nothing hard to understand. It's just basically r minus epsilon by r power n, and that's less than 1, and you keep exponentiating, you'll get 0. Okay, so assuming that these are normal vectors, and these are independent dimensions, so as I said, we could do various distance metrics between two vectors. You could do, the most obvious one is, let's say, the Euclidean distance between vectors, which is the Euclidean distance between points. You could do that. Okay. Another thing that you could do is this cosine theta metric, which basically is saying, take the dot product between the vectors and normalize it. You guys know what dot product is, right? I mean, I'm sure you just looked it up before coming. So dot product, normalize it by the norm of the vector, the size of the vector, the two vectors involved. And that would essentially be, it's called cosine theta basically because what it's computing is the cosine theta between the cosine of the angle between the two vectors. Okay, if you take dot product and divide it by the norm of both the vectors, that's what you're getting. Okay, now upfront, you could do this, and you could also have defined distance as a Euclidean distance between the two vectors normalized. You could have done that, right? Now, however, it turns out that cosine theta metric is, people love it for some reason. Now, the question is, why do they love it more than, let's say, Euclidean distance measure? The normal kind of arguments you would get are kind of faulty because they'll assume that the Euclidean distance is defined just this way. That means it's not normalized, okay? Now, if it's not normalized, you know the usual problems. You know, you could have actually, notice that for the same exact data, if you don't call it a vector, but you call it a bag, you'd have used Jaccard metric. Okay, that's a different similarity measure. You know, you're just thinking of these as bags and you're now computing the similarity between them. And you could do Jaccard by itself or Jaccard with normalization, so that you take into account the size of the bag upfront, okay, and divide all the coefficients by the size of the bag. Okay, so that you're only thinking of the fraction of the bag which is apples, fraction of the bag which is oranges, fraction of the bag which is kumquats and whatever. And then use that to compute your bag similarity matrix. Normalization is important, because if you don't normalize, then you would wind up just having this unnatural affinity to large documents. You just think as if large documents are more likely to be the answer. So you'd wind up giving those as the answers most of the time. Okay. So you can actually normalize Euclidean distance too, the same way. And cosine theta, the simplest way of thinking of dot product metric, simplest way of thinking of dot product metric is just that. And in some sense, the reason you look for the cosine theta is you're normalizing it with respect to the size of the vector. Okay? So that the similarity is always between 0 and 1 in this particular case. Now, what's interesting ultimately as to why people like cosine theta as against many other measures that people have tried, actually people have tried Euclidean distance, and they still try Jaccard similarity metric in many cases. Okay? It's not actually, there is no theoretical explanation for this, because any theoretical explanation would probably be faulty, because we are starting with vectors whose dimensions are not necessarily independent, and we are acting as if they are independent. Okay, so all you can say is it works, really. You know, more people have done precision recall studies ultimately. Okay, so there were two, using everything else the same and using Euclidean one in one program and vector similarity in another program, they would have basically done information retrieval for various types of queries over random populations of users. And they would have asked them, okay, for the top 10 results I'm showing you according to algorithm 1, list, you know, tick all the relevant ones. And for the other one, tick all the relevant ones. And then I get to draw the 11-point precision recall curves and see, you know, how do these compare with respect to each other. And basically, the general idea for the few studies that have been done is that vector similarity does better than Euclidean distance measure. I can give you one possible kind of a anecdotal example that might make you get the feel for why vector similarity might be useful. Okay, this is a single example. This is our example on 10 documents. First 5 are basically database-y documents. The second 5 are basically statistics, linear regression-y documents. Okay. Now, remember that the similarity, basically you can do the doc-doc similarity, because query itself is a doc. It's a small document. So if I were to compute the document-document similarity matrix using my method, whichever method I like, so I can do it once with Euclidean and the other with the vector space. And what I would like to see is that these guys are more similar to each other, those guys are more similar to each other. And the in-between, essentially, there is no similarity. That means a thing from there cannot really be very similar to the thing from here. Okay? And here is, if you kind of visualize what happens, this is how your distance matrix would be. Notice that this is a 10 by 10 grid. Okay? So the number in any particular grid cell is the similarity between the documents. So for example, this one, the similarity between document 7 and document 9. And clearly, this would be a symmetric grid. You know, it would be on above the diagonal and below the diagonal, you have the same exact shape. Okay? And the assumption here is the whiter the cell is, the more similar the two documents are. The darker the cell is, the less similar the two documents are. And not surprisingly, you do see that the diagonal is white as white can be, because you are talking about similarity between D1 and D1. And if you can't be similar to yourself, you have major problems anyway. So that's not a good similarity measure at all, if it doesn't even realize that D1 is very similar to D1. Okay? So the real question then is, how do you find the similarity between the rest? Okay? You notice that in the vector space, you would notice that this quadrant is nice and white. This quadrant is nice and white. these two quadrants are dark, showing that basically the similarity as seen by the vector similarity metric between a document from that set and a document from this set is actually quite low. I mean, these are all degrees, really. Okay, they're all degrees. But if you look at it, the degree is in such a way that this is much darker than either of these two quadrants. Whereas for the Euclidean one, you can see what's happening. You still see that Euclidean, in essence, this is part of more white quadrant than this quadrant. However, it's not nearly as good at differentiating similar from dissimilar. This is an anecdotal example. This is not really telling you. In essence, what you might say is the cosine theta metric seems to make similar things look more similar and dissimilar things look more dissimilar. And there are metrics like that. Those are basically the, you know, anything which does this, that, you know, you are in essence transforming some similarity metric in such a way that the dissimilar ones become very dissimilar and similar ones look very similar, which is useful for us in our particular case. So this is a useful way to think of why people actually seem to be using vector similarity metrics. The real big reason is everybody uses it, and people have done precision recall studies and found that in most cases, if you keep everything else constant, vector similarity works fine compared to others. Okay? Okay, so it's obvious that the way you would actually use the metric here itself is if you have a query, you would think of the query itself as a document, which is also a vector now, and then you would compute its vector similarity metric with all the other documents, and then whichever has the largest value, because it's a similarity metric, whichever has the largest value, you take that to be the most similar, and then return that. That's the basic idea. Okay, it went away. So in this particular case, I'm sure you can look it up later. So I was using an example database index, okay? And I think if you the terms here are T1 is database, T2 is SQL, and so on. So my query really is database index, so T1 and T3, that's my query, okay? And so if I use that as the vector and then I compute the distances, these are the distances I'm getting. And I have decided that D5 basically is the highest value, so D5 is the best answer. And moreover, you do realize that these are all higher values, these are all lower values. So even if you take the top 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, you could actually see the similarity start taking a nosedive when you come this side. Okay. Now, that's basically the vector similarity measure. And then what we will do now is, so in some sense we normalized all these metrics. When we talked about all these metrics, we are normalizing them with respect to the size of the document itself. The other thing we could do is somehow change the vector representation such that it takes into account the way terms are distributed over the document. That's something that we were talking about earlier. You know, the terms that are appearing all over the place are likely to be not as important. Okay? And the terms that are appearing only in one or two documents are likely to be very important because they are differentiating between documents. Okay, so one thing you could do is basically take, so that's one aspect. The other one we also talked about last time is if there is a word in this document, if this document is very large to begin with, then the frequency of words in the document might actually be also very large. Okay, the number of the instances of the word the would be much larger if I have a much larger document, because I'll wind up using a lot of them. So another thing you could do is normalize the term frequencies, normalize the number of times a term appears in a document by the maximum number of times any term appears in that document. Maximum number of times any term at all appears in that document. So that's another thing, okay? So you would use these two factors. So for each term, you first find out its normalized term frequency, and you then multiply it by a measure which shows how rare or frequent this term is. And this measure is the inverse document frequency. What it basically is saying is if this term is appearing in every document in the every document in the corpus, this measure should become zero. And if it is appearing in, you know, only one of the many, many documents in the corpus, this measure should be high. Okay? So it's basically an inverse measure, but you also want it to actually become zero, not just small, but become zero when in fact it appears in every one of the documents. Okay? So the way you would wind up defining inverse document frequency, it's not written here, but basically is to take the logarithm. So if n is the total number of documents in the entire collection, ni is the number of documents in which the ith term is appearing. Okay? Now, if it is very frequent, then ni is equal to n. I mean, it's completely frequent. If it's very ubiquitous, then ni equal to n, so n by n, 1. Otherwise, it would be n by a small number, which will be a large number. And so, in a sense, that's giving already the inverseness with respect to frequency of the term. And I take a log of it. Now, you could think of it as one way to think of log. First of all, logarithm is a monotonic function. So the way n over ni is changing is the way log n over ni also changes. In the sense, if one is increasing, this one also is increasing. The other is decreasing, this also decreases. So it's monotonic. It's a monotonic transformation. However, it's a highly nonlinear monotonic transformation. You know, I'm taking a log. Why? Okay. One thing, of course, I could say is, well, if n by n is 1, log of 1 is 0. Pretty darn good. That's what we wanted. Okay. But it turns out that actually you can make more interesting reasons as to why it makes sense to take log of n over ni. This is connected to the idea of information theory, in a sense. Okay. So if you have an event which will occur with probability P, okay, and so it's not definitely going to occur. So tomorrow this event may or may not occur with probability P. It will occur with probability P. And your friend comes and tells you, I'm going to sell you information. I'm going to tell you for sure whether or not this event is going to occur tomorrow. For sure whether or not this event is going to occur tomorrow, I'll tell you this information. Would you buy it or not? And how much are you willing to pay to buy this information? And this is essentially the question of how much information is there in knowing whether this event will occur or not. Now, look at the two extreme cases. When P is 1, that means it's going to happen every day, you wouldn't be paying very large amount of money to get that. Okay, so in some sense, the information is related to 1 over the probability of occurrence. And in fact, it turns out, I won't go into it too much detail, but now I'd be happy to send you guys mail talking about more of this, but it turns out that if you define it as logarithm of the inverse of probability, it would wind up having nice connection to the number of bits you would need to encode the information. So log is also connected to the number of bits to encode like a large number. Okay? So basically, you can make this nice argument that IDF is in terms of log because that's sort of the information that's present in telling, you know, in this particular keyword. If it's very frequent, it's not very highly informative. Okay? So I have IDF I is log over n of ni, and the TF of I is essentially the frequency of a term in that document divided by the maximum frequency of any term in that document. Having done this, then you would have gotten a TF value and an IDF value for each term. You multiply TF by IDF to get the weight for that term. Okay? So rather than actually use the number of occurrences of the term as the weight for the term, which is what we were doing in the original bag model or the original vector model, we will start using these real valued numbers, which are TF times IDF. Okay, and this is basically a very popular idea, and this is called the TF-IDF weighting scheme, and it seems to improve in general. First of all, you can see why this makes sense. I mean, the more frequent terms are not as useful as less frequent terms. Okay, and secondly, it also has been shown to do quite well in many experiments, precision recall experiments. So TF-IDF winds up being like one of the bread and butter ideas. So TF-IDF and vector space are the two bread and butter ideas in information retrieval. Okay, you'd be surprised how many most recent papers as of like written last month would still be talking about this. And you know, why aren't you taking inverse document sequence into account? Why aren't you normalizing? So on. So one thing that you have to realize now is, A, for each document, you are actually first normalizing the weights by taking the TF weights and IDF weights for each term in the document. Okay. Now, the TF weight of a term is document specific. The IDF weight of a term is it document specific? It's a collection specific. So IDF basically is a one argument function. So it's just basically IDF of a single term. IDF of a single term, I. And TF, on the other hand, is a two argument function. It's the term frequency of the ith term in the jth document. Okay? And so you normalize given a collection and documents. First you'll compute the normalized TF for all the documents, and then you compute, of course, the corpus level IDF for all the documents. So IDF is a global measure, TF is a local measure. Okay? Then you would have gotten the normalized vectors, and then when you do the cosine similarity metric, you would take dot product and you renormalize again with the sizes of the vector. Because just because I did this kind of a normalization, it doesn't mean that all the vectors I will get in the end would have exactly size 1. Okay? So I will again renormalize when I do cos theta metric, because in essence I'm taking dot product divided by the norms of the two vectors. So there are like two levels of normalization that are going on in general. One little thing that's sort of kind of interesting, which is, it's very obvious how to do TF-IDF for normal documents. What do you do for the query, which is also a document, remember? Okay, what do you do for the query? Now, so the terms in the query can also be weighted with the TF-IDF way. So the question would be, what do you do, right? And the worry, of course, is that since the query is too small, that is too few a word to begin with, the TF weights of many of the terms would obviously be zero, right? So one thing that people try to do is they actually consider kind of a linear offset. For example, it's like 0.5 plus 0.5 times TF IDF. This is done just so that, you know, because of the size of the query, many terms haven't become zero. Now you might say this makes not much, too much sense, and actually it doesn't make too much sense to me. I mean, if it's making sense to you, you should explain to me why it makes sense to you, because if there are no terms in the query, that basically because I didn't care about those terms. In essence, again, it's one of the scenarios where doing this seems to actually improve precision and recall. Okay? I mean, I would be upfront with you. There are things for which there are great reasoning, and there are things for which you try. You know, IR, unfortunately, is one of these things where, you know, for any 10 ideas you come up with, 4 have great, beautiful math behind it, and 6 because it works. Okay? But even when you go to it works, you tend to go in some reasonable direction. For example, I would say that the IDF measure is not exactly, I did not give you a watertight argument as to why that's the only way to define the IDF measure. I just said, look, you know, if you do it that way, at least it has some connection to information theory. Okay, so it's sort of proof by citation to another eminent authority outside the room. Okay, in this particular case, you're just offsetting it. And there also are cases where people just say, to heck with the term frequencies, I'll just use the inverse document frequencies. The query is too small to begin with. Let's assume that if the query term is present, its weight is exactly its occurrence weight. And I'll only take the inverse document frequency. Now notice that inverse document frequency of a term has nothing to do with the query. It has everything to do with the corpus. You see what I'm saying? So that just comes out directly. Okay. The other possibility, actually, in the queries case, is to say, look, the TF and IDF are for the document, and the query is really decided by the user. And if the user wants to say, you know, wants to say, happy life or something, okay, as the query, and they want to put 5 happy and 1 life or something like that. And this is not the best example, but, you know, suppose they said that. So somehow happy should be given more weight than the life part, okay? You should allow them to do that, okay? Can you do this in Google? Try it. Go home and say, not whether it's happy or life, but you could say happy life and happy, 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 happy life, and see if the top 5 results, the top 10 results are the same or not. Okay, that would give you an idea as to whether you can actually affect the weight of the term or not. Okay, but it's a reasonable idea. You should allow people to give higher weights, except most people don't do it because for the same reason most people don't use the Boolean model, because users really don't really know what they're looking for. They would say we are more interested in happiness than in life, but in fact they might well be talking about something else. And so just take the keywords and show the top 10 results and let them decide. Okay. A better idea, of course, is see what they do, which is if they wound up, you know, they said happy life and they wound up clicking on skydiving pages mostly, right? You pretty much know what's more important for them, life or happy. I'm not necessarily making any value judgments on skydivers around here, but then you know that in essence, because they are looking at that page more, then that's basically what they're really looking for, neither happy nor life. It's a skydiving, that's what, you know, so show more of those, okay? So that's the relevance feedback stuff. We'll talk about that in a minute. This is actually doing for the same example. You can, you know, stare at it outside the class. For the same example, doing without TF-IDF weights and with TF-IDF weights, and talking about how the similarity numbers change. And you can look at them and see if it makes sense to you or not. Okay. In this particular case, in fact, the similarity measures do change. The most similar one in the TF-IDF case is D2, and in the non-weighted TF-IDF case, the normal term occurrence case is D5. Okay. So the summary vector model starts with a bogus assumption, which is that all the dimensions are independent, and runs with it by taking cosine theta between these dimensions, and then does some useful things about reweighting the term frequencies and in terms of how frequent they are in the document itself, and also how ubiquitous they are in the entire corpus. Now it's important to know that TF-IDF is not connected in any sense to the vector spaceness of the metric. You can use TF-IDF weights to do Jaccard similarity metric, right? Because nothing in the TF-IDF takes the vector aspect into account. All you're talking about is, how frequent is this term across the corpus, and how frequent is this term in the actual document itself. So you could do TF-IDF with any other distance measure, cosine theta versus Euclidean versus Jaccard similarity. It's just an orthogonal idea. Makes sense, but it's an orthogonal idea. Okay. There are tons of things that vector similarity measures. This entire model, the vector model as well as the bag model as well as the Boolean model, that they don't capture. Okay. I can just get started and keep on talking about how many things they don't do. But some of the main ones, for example, as I said, is it starts with a bogus assumption that terms are independent. And as I said, it seems to work. But then, have you tried not taking independence into account and seeing whether it works any better? The answer is, in fact, for those cases where people have tried, for example, starting with data like date and reducing the dimensionality so that you would wind up going into a space which has more independent terms, and doing ranking in that reduced dimension space, they have shown that in studies that improves precision and recall. They have shown that. Does Google use it? No. Why? Because it takes time. After you give the query, it takes time to do this analysis, oftentimes. And nobody else is doing it. And you already sold your soul to Google, and so it doesn't have to do it. And I'm not making this up. In fact, I was just reading a very interesting paper from 2005 Information Retrieval Conference, where they were doing the following interesting study, which is, in fact, this is connected to relevance feedback. One way you can say whether or not somebody is interested in a particular page normally is they don't necessarily have to say, I say this is relevant. If they click, you assume it's relevant for them, right? One way, you know, if you're trying to learn user preferences by relevance feedback, which we'll be talking about in a minute, the way, one easy thing to do is if they click on the page, that means that's because probably they like it. So I'll assume that click is relevant decision. So these people wanted to check the hypothesis. Is it true that the clicks are unbiased estimate of relevance judgment by the user? And they did the following interesting thing. They took Google, they took the top 10 results, and they had machine 1, which shows the actual top 10 results, machine 2, which skips swaps the first and second result. Okay, the user won't know when they submitted the answer to the query to the user, to the Google. They would still say here, you know, 1, 2, 3, etc. up to 10. Here they'll say 2, 1, etc. up to 10. They won't know. I mean, none of you would know which is the most relevant one. Okay, and the third one, they actually did the entire reversal of the top 10. 10, 9, 8, 7, etc. up to 1. And they basically looked at two measures. One is how much are users staring at the snippets. This neat stuff. In fact, if you are into actually evaluating some of these things, you would need to kind of, you know, look at how much are people staring at it. We actually realize whether people are interested in us or not by seeing whether they're staring at us, whether they have glassy-eyed stares, whether they have completely closed eyes when they're looking at us. These things we use to decide, you know, how things are going. And, you know, you should use that in, you know, in deciding whether people like the search engine they're using or not. So they use the fixation, which is how much they're looking at, how many milliseconds they looked at each of the abstracts. And for that, you need obviously pretty good pieces of machinery. Okay, so they put that. And the other is clicking, which is which one did they click. And here is the most interesting thing. They found that users look at the first and the second abstracts almost with the same amount of time. But they wind up clicking the first one almost twice as often than they click the second one. Now this looks to mean that Google really knows what it's doing. Unfortunately, you go to this one where they change the order. Top one became the second one became the first one. They did the exact same thing. Now they're spending more time clicking the first one in this, which is actually the second one here. Okay? So really they started believing the Google and deciding whatever Google says is what I wanted to begin with. And this is an actual user study done with Cornell undergraduate students. And I'm sure those are dumb people, and I'm sure we have much more unbiased undergrads here. But it tells you how technology actually biases us, you know. So I mean, this is again the same point I'm sort of making earlier on too, but it's a nice paper. I'll send you a link to it. You can look at it. But it shows how how things will change. In fact, there's a completely different example for this. There's a guy called Stuart Russell. One of the friends here is reading Stuart Russell's AI book just in the beginning of the class. So Russell once wrote this paper and submitted it to AAAI, which is the National Conference on AI. When he wrote the paper, he had no clue what this paper was really saying. I mean, it's an important paper, but he wasn't sure whether it's an important enough idea or not. So he submitted it, thinking the reviewers would tell him whether it's an important enough idea or not. So reviewers looked at the paper. These were the days before double-blind reviewing. So they look at the fact that Russell wrote this. He said, yeah, I can't actually make sense of this paper, but Russell wrote this. And, you know, the guy is a smart guy. Let him talk about it. So, in fact, when he started giving the talk in the conference, he stood up and said, look, you know, when I wrote this paper, I had no clue actually what I'm saying. I thought the reviewers will tell me. But the reviewers said, since Russell wrote it, let him talk about it. Again, the same kind of bias, okay? So anyway, the reason I got into that whole thing is independence of terms is a bogus assumption and yet things seem to work. Well, things seem to work because we assume whatever is given by Google is what is right. And in fact, that's what I just showed you, that if you change the Google thing, as long as you say it's Google brand, you know, that's, there's this rebranding. I mean, we used to have, and in India, we would have all the brands that are available except with a small I, so Sony, and then there'll be a small I, India, okay? And then something else and a small brand, India. And I would go for the Sony copy because, you know, somehow the copy, and when you're buying the copy, you might also buy the more interesting name, okay? So ultimately, it's the Google name that mattered to the user, not the relevance, okay? The second one, of course, is because you don't handle independence, you would not wind up handling synonymy and polysemy. That means if you said one word and there's a different word above, you know, which also means the same thing, and this particular document has that word in spades, but not the first word, you should be able to give this document. It won't see it. And if a word has multiple meanings, and the meaning of this word in the context of other keywords is stabilized towards one direction of the meaning rather than other meaning, you would be able to tell that. The vector space cannot. There are lots and lots of problems, and yet we get by. Because, I mean, before Google, we had no way of actually doing, I mean, before big search engines, we did not have any retrieval to begin with. Okay? Okay, so what I would tell you today, so there are many, many problems, of course. I would talk about this, which is dimensionality reduction. I mentioned to you why dimensionality reduction is important. And I'll tell you, for example, at least in the case of linear changes to dimensions, that means the new dimensions are actually linear combinations of real dimensions in a much smaller dimensional space. If that is the case, they can get back to you. They can get back and tell you the real dimension. Okay? We will do that under the guise of latent semantic indexing. It's a great, beautiful idea, but nobody uses it. And nobody being Google doesn't use it. Okay? You know, I'm still in two minds whether you will yell at me because I taught you that, because you guys are already seem to have made up your mind. Just tell me what Google does, and that's enough. Or should I teach you? But I think I would teach you at some point of time the latent semantic indexing. The other is a much simpler idea, the relevance feedback. I want to show that to you. It's a very simple way to do it. I mean, basically, this was my example of, you know, somebody gives happy life, whatever query, and then they're clicking on Britney Spears pages most of the time. And so the next 10 better be all about Britney Spears rather than what they really asked for. Okay? And that's basically relevance feedback. And it turns out that there are many, many ways of actually implementing this. And one way is the following, which is if you are thinking in terms of vectors, right, the original query is some vector. Okay? Now, having shown that vector, having given that vector to as a query, the search engine then goes off and gets 100 documents and shows it to you. And then suppose you have infinite patience and you waded through all these documents, 100 documents, and said, this are relevant. This are not relevant. Okay? Then all I need to say is forget about the old query vector. What you do is more representative of what you're looking for than what you said you wanted. Okay? So if these documents are the ones you thought were relevant, these documents are the ones that you thought were not relevant, what I would do is I would take the average of all the relevant documents, and now these are vectors, right? So you can add up vectors and take an average of vectors. Okay? The centroid of these vectors. And that's enough, you would almost say. Except I can actually do a little more, which is these are the bad guys. We don't want them. So you take the centroid of those guys and take the vector difference between them. That's your new query vector. Okay, so you get them started. Yeah, give me any query, and I'll give you 100 results. Then you click on what you like and what you don't like. Then I'll actually tell you what your real query is. And not only would I tell you, I would run this query on my corpus and give you the results. And more often than not, people are happy with this. Okay? So this is the correct way to do relevance feedback if in fact the user has looked at the entire corpus and said, for the query that I have in my head, these are the things that I believe are relevant, these are the things that I believe are not relevant in the entire corpus. So then my query actually is this. So then I'll tell you, yeah, what you're really looking for is this. Now obviously nobody will give me money for doing this because they've already looked at the entire corpus and I told them, well, if this is what you wanted, really what you wanted was this. Yeah, you know, it's no use. So instead what we do is we jump around a little bit and put a couple of alphas and some gammas and we are in business. So what we do is let Q0 be the query that the user gave. Okay, and then you showed just the top 10 results for that query Q0. Then the user may have taken some of them as relevant and some of them as irrelevant. So this is the fraction of the documents that you showed to the user that they said were relevant. This is the fraction of the documents that you showed to the user that they said was irrelevant. Okay, so what you basically wind up doing is, in essence, previously remember this becomes the query and this guy would be forgotten. Now you will say, well, you know, I shouldn't make up my mind so fast. Let me keep alpha times Q0 plus beta times what they think is relevant minus gamma times what they think is irrelevant. You know, I mean, there are areas whose you know, life is based on making up new thresholds and writing them. And normally when you write thresholds, always use Greek letters. You know, it looks much more imposing than just ABC, and that won't get you anywhere. So now you essentially have, so alpha, which is how much you believe user already had a clue when they asked the query, beta, how much you believe we should change his relevance judgment, and gamma, how much you believe his irrelevance judgment. And, you know, you set some numbers and you try it out, okay? That's relevance feedback. Isn't that an easy technique? Extremely easy. I mean, I've been talking about relevance feedback for a long, long time. Here's a simple way to do relevance feedback. Okay, there could have been many other things you could have done to do the same idea of relevance feedback, which is, if somebody shows you, these are all the relevant ones, these are all the irrelevant ones for what I have in my head, this is basically 20 questions, right? I mean, I won't tell you what I'm thinking of. I'll tell you it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it is this, it's this, it's this, it's this. So what's the concept I'm thinking of? That problem is called classification learning problem. If I show you positive examples and negative examples of what it is I'm thinking of, you are supposed to figure out what it is that I'm thinking of. Much of learning, and a large amount of learning happens that way. You know, I give you apples when you do it right, so kind of I'm sharing that kind of a positive. I give you zeros when you do it wrong, so I'm showing you that those are the negative examples, and you are somehow supposed to learn from that. If you don't, you would still be in the grade school, hopefully, okay? So this is classification learning, and in fact, you could use classification learning to improve search. That makes much more sense. In fact, everybody, two different people giving the same set of keywords might actually be looking for completely different results at this as their top results. Okay, the classic example that they give, that you know, information retrieval community gives, is the keyword Michael Jordan. Okay, who is Michael Jordan? What? Who? What? Researcher. This part of the class doesn't live in the real world. For most people, who is Michael Jordan? Baseball player, basketball player. So I'm also kind of vaguely there, but basketball player, right? So most people who say Michael Jordan are looking for Michael Jordan, the basketball player's page. If you are taking AI, information retrieval, or anything in computer science, and if you say Michael Jordan, that means two things. Either you are really looking for the researcher Michael Jordan, or you are having too much life outside of the classroom. And so you really should not be looking for basketball players. You should, if you say Michael Jordan, you should be looking for Michael Jordan, the researcher, because he's done tons and tons of papers on this stuff. Okay. So the example is, how do I tell just by looking at the user's profile that when this guy says Michael Jordan, this is what should be shown to them? all of relevance feedback will get it to you except after it first shows you, you know, all the basketball player things, and you say, no, 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 I like the 100th one very nicely, top 99 are relevant, and then it will slowly, after 10 years, will figure out what you're looking for. And the hope is, can you learn the model and keep it, and anytime you log in, Google will know you, and then say, yeah, you know, this guy is the dweeb character. So Michael Jordan, the guy in Berkeley who does, you know, latent semantic indexing, clustering, and all that stuff. Okay, now, should we be doing that? Of course we should be doing that. Is Google doing it? No. Is there any money for Google to do that? Not very clear, because, you know, of the many, many things they can do to improve the search engine, they would do those that will improve their share price first, okay, until somebody else actually starts giving them a run for the money. Okay, I mean, why, it's, what is interesting to me actually is, you know, this is one of the articles that I showed you earlier. Google has really nice public relations image. I have nothing against Google. It's just that I think any big company should be seen with a large amount of skepticism. You know, I think it's not that Bill Gates looks ugly, that's why we hate Microsoft. You know, it's just a monopoly, and monopolies kill competition, and so good ideas may not come out. So anything which becomes too big, you should be worried as a consumer. And as a researcher, you should definitely not think that whichever is the dominant view is the right view. And if you do that, you don't need to actually be a researcher. You don't need to go that far. Okay. That's the relevance feedback. I obviously did not say too much about the indexing stuff. I'll say one sentence, and then I'll let you read it. And next class, if you need to, I'll explain again. I already showed you what inverted indexes look like. The major difference between using an inverted index and not using an inverted index is that if you don't use an inverted index, if you're given a query and you have a bunch of documents whose vectors representation is already given to you, the most obvious thing you can do is you'd say, for each term in my dictionary, which is the lexicon, which is the set of all the terms in the world, if this term appears both in the document and my query, then I increase the similarity measure for the document and query by a little bit. And I do this one pass through the entire lexicon, looking at the query and the document. This is the obvious thing you would do if you don't have any indexing capability. It works fine if you have 10 documents, pretty fine, okay? But when you have millions of documents, and most of them are sparse, that's very important. Most of them are sparse in the sense that when you ask this question, for this term, is it in the query and is it in the document? The answer for most times you ask this question is no. You still wasted time asking that question. So the right thing would be to somehow start with the terms that are in the query and ask, who are the documents who have these terms? And only do the computation for those documents. That's exactly what inverted index gives you. So there are two little algorithms that you should be able to understand in the inverted index slides. You know, one which is a naive way, which has a loop over the entire lexicon. For each term in the lexicon, if it's in the document and in the query, then I do a little bit of computation, computing the similarity. The other smarter way is for each term in the query, go into the inverted index and get me the list of documents that have this word, this term, okay? And for those, just do the computation. And in one case, it's proportional to the size of the query. The other case, it's proportional to the size of the lexicon. And humongous difference, okay? So I think I said this, but you can ask me again questions next time. And then next time we'll also talk about Project One formally, in the sense that he'll say formally on now, but it's kind of informally on right now. So if you have nothing to do on Labor Day weekend, you know, start thinking about it. And then when I come back next class, I will do one of two things, which I haven't yet figured out right now. Either I'll go into PageRank and Authorities Hubs, which is the search engine stuff, or I'll do latent semantic indexing. I haven't yet figured out which one I'll do. I'll send you mail as to which one I'll do.